The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. May God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has one call on its oral submission docket. It is the State of Texas, ex rel. Karen Angelini versus the Honorable Phil Hartberger, Justice. A petition for emergency writ of quo warranto. The court has allotted 20 minutes for relator and respondent to present their arguments. Relator may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. These arguments are being recorded. If you wish to purchase a tape of the argument, you may make application with our clerk. You're ready to hear argument from the relator.
May it please the court, Mr. Stuart Bowen will present argument to the relator. 5 minutes.
Good morning. I'm Stuart Bowen, here representing the state of Texas in relation to Karen Angelini in this cause, and I'm joined by my associate, Steve Coble, at the table. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, 30 days ago, Governor George W. Bush appointed Karen Angelini to fill an office of justice on the 4th Court of Appeals in San Antonio, which the respondent vacated by his own unilateral and voluntary resignation from that office on June 20th of this year. But for 30 days, Ms. Angelini has been unable to assume her duties on the 4th Court.
Mr. Bowen?
Yes, sir.
Has the relator Angelini taken the oath of office?
Yes, sir. She took that oath on July 14th.
Does our record show that she's taken the oath of office?
I believe the affidavit submitted demonstrates that she has taken the oath.
Do we have a copy of the oath in the record?
A copy of the oath is not in the record, Your Honor, but I would be happy to submit it after submission. The respondent has refused to concede the office to which Karen Angelini now holds title. Thus, the state on relation Karen Angelini has brought this quo warranto proceeding, asking the court to resolve the matter of contested title to the Office of Associate Justice on the 4th Court of Appeals. The call submits a concise issue of law, namely, whether the legal acceptance of a prospective resignation submitted by a person holding the Office of Justice on the 4th Court of Appeals creates a vacancy in that office which can be filled by appointment, and which will continue until the next succeeding general election. Resolving this issue returns on interpreting the word vacancy as it's used in Article 5, Section 28 of the Texas Constitution, the judicial vacancy provision, and Section 201.023 of the Texas Election Code.
Ms. Bowen, before you get to that, are you aware of any quo warranto action that this court's ruled on where it has not first sent it back to district court for it to handle the case?
Justice Enoch, the last time this court had an original proceeding in quo warranto was in the early 20s. But the statute, the Civil Practice Remedy Code, and the Constitution vest concurrent jurisdiction for quo warranto proceedings. The Texas Constitution clearly states that the legislature may vet this court with authority to hear these extraordinary proceedings, and they've done that in Chapter 22 of the Government Code.
Did that change? Actually, I seem to recall a case by the state of Martineau that was like 43, where the court did exactly the same thing. It said this is a case that should be brought in district court first and dismissed without prejudice. Has something really changed in the state of the law that says we take quo warrantos before they go to the district court now?
Your Honor, I believe that the state of the law is that the Texas Constitution vests this court, actually vested the legislature with the authority to empower this court to hear quo warranto proceedings as original proceedings.
Was that a change since 43? I mean, has that been a change in the law since 43, or are we really dealing with the same
Well, no, I...
Concurrent jurisdiction, both the district and the Supreme Court, and the case that says, if that's the case, it's got to go to the district court first.
We're dealing with the concurrent jurisdiction issue, and since an original proceeding could have originally been brought in district court, it may have started there, but or it could be brought here, and that is what has happened. It is somewhat novel in that respect. The state's argument will briefly review the facts, analyze the Texas constitutional and statutory provisions involved in the relevant case law. But first, a few words about what this case is not about. It's not about whether filling public offices by election or appointment is preferable. There will be an election in November concerning this office, and the appointment will continue until then, pursuant to Article 5, Section 28. It's not about whether prospective resignations are prohibited in Texas. They clearly are not. Indeed, Section 0.023 anticipates that there will be prospective resignations, but tells how those resignations should be handled once accepted.
Let me ask you about that, because under 0.023, you can have a prospective resignation, but it cannot be more prospective than 8 days.
Since the 1989 amendment, an automatic acceptance occurs 8 days after its receipt by the appropriate authority. And at that point, the officeholder continues pursuant to the Texas Constitution as a holdover in that office, pending appointment, which permits flexibility in the appointment.
But under your position, if the governor wanted to immediately fill a position for which there has been a resignation, that resignation can be no more prospective than 8 days. Would you agree with that, under your interpretation?
Yes, under the statute's bright line rule, which states that 8 days after receipt, a vacancy is created, then at that point thereafter, the governor is free to exercise his constitutional powers of appointment.
Are you familiar with section, sorry, I'm old pair of glasses. Eyes don't work that well anymore. 201.001C,
yes,
regarding
sir.
An officer election.
Yes, sir.
Is there a different rule for somebody who's not in office than somebody who is in office?
No, sir. The 201.01C applies the resignation provision to officers elect, and which means that if an officer elect chose to resign prospectively, an extraordinary circumstance, if immediately elected he decided to resign prospectively, then the same vacancy upon acceptance rule that is prescribed would apply.
So if you are an officer elect and you resign 9 days before your term is to start, then you never take office?
Well, if an officer elect decided that he wanted to respond to resign in such a manner, and presumably the certificate of election issues shortly after the officer is elected, then if it's possible that 9 days could elapse and you decided to prospectively resign, then yes, you would have a vacancy that would trigger.
And you never take office, even though the statute talks about an officer elect who intends to qualify for the office but desires to resign at a subsequent date. Intends to qualify just means he intends to do it, but he's never going to do it because of your 8-day rule.
Well, under those extraordinary facts, which are not presented, I think that the officer-elect could take advantage of the holdover provision at some level.
But he has no right to assume the office, your position.
At that
if
point,
the
authority
days.
To appoint a replacement would begin, but given the standard process of appointing replacement, I believe that the holdover provision arguably would apply.
Now, all the provisions we're talking about are subject to language that says, for the purposes of this title,
that's right.
The vacancy occurs.
Yes, sir.
Could we avoid some of these problems by drawing a distinction between vacancies for purposes of an election and vacancies for purpose of somebody not working and drawing their paycheck anymore?
I think that what that provision says is that for purposes of this title, it prescribes the time when a vacancy occurs. That's subchapter B of chapter 201. And that means the succeeding seven provisions state that for persons to whom this title applies, a vacancy shall occur when, for example, a Court of Appeals judge dies, takes an incompatible office, is removed in a legal proceeding, or becomes ineligible. And therefore, for purposes of this title, that's when vacancies occur. However, that provision, or in fact no other provision in Title 12, defines vacancy. And indeed, vacancy thus should be treated in its common meaning and in the unambiguous manner in which it is used in each of those seven provisions in subchapter B.
Mr. Bowen, Justice Jack Hightower submitted a prospective resignation, just like Justice Harburger in this case.
Yes, sir.
Under your interpretation, Justice Abbott would have been eligible, or the governor would have been eligible to appoint Justice Abbott to this court and oust Justice Hightower before Justice Hightower wanted to be on the court?
Well, what would happen is that 8 days...
8 days expired and the governor did nothing after receipt of Justice Hightower's letter.
The vacancy upon acceptance rule, pursuant to the 1989 amendment, kicks in at 8 days after it is received by the authority, with the appropriate authority. But it did
in Justice Hightower's case.
Yes, sir. It did.
But it did not. I mean, no action was taken.
That's right. No action was taken because imputed to the governor in his constitutional powers of appointment is an element of discretion, in which he generally takes, governors generally take a month to review applicants and assign persons to interview and then finally select. But that does not, and that means that a prospective resignation generally averages about a month or a little bit over. As Justice Hightower's did, it was a little bit longer than a month, but it indeed was much shorter than the prospective day submitted by
Mr.
respondent,
Bowen,
which is almost 200 days in advance. Yes, sir, Justice Baker.
Didn't the governor actually tell the public in October that he intended to appoint Justice Abbott to that position when it became vacant? And isn't what you said not an answer to Judge Gonzalez's question? The governor may have time to look around, but does it reign to say that the governor has no discretion? He must accept it. And that's the question that Justice Gonzalez asked you. He either accepts it or 8 days later under the statute, it's effective. Is that correct? So is it then a conclusion that Justice Hightower's tenure on the court was over 8 days after he tendered his letter?
No, Your Honor, because he continued as a holdover pursuant to the Texas Constitution's holdover provision, which allows...
But that's a different statute, isn't it?
And it applied in that case. And it applies in every case where an officer continues in an office after the expiration of his office holding, but nevertheless no appointment has been made to fill that office. And that was certainly the case in Justice Hightower's situation. Third, this case is not about the anomalous patterns of exchange of letters between resigners from judicial offices and governors, past or present. These exhibits are not relevant to this court because it is faced with a statute and a constitutional provision that are unambiguous on their face. And as the court recently held in KOV Service Motors, that when a statute is unambiguous on its face, then the canons of construction, like customer practice, don't apply. But what this case is about is what effect the respondent's voluntary and unilateral resignation had upon his office holding. Now, the Texas constitutional provision that we've been addressing says, in pertinent part, that vacancies in the office of judges of the Court of Civil Appeals shall be filled by the governor until the next succeeding general election. Respondent says that the word vacancy here means that a prospective resignation takes effect at a future date specified unless otherwise provided by law, and cites a number of other jurisdictions that hold that. Well, in Texas, we have provided otherwise by law, and that is the unambiguous statute found in 201.023 of the Texas Election Code, which says if an officer submits his resignation and this is the key phrase, whether to be effective immediately or at a future date, a vacancy occurs on the date the resignation is accepted by the appropriate authority or on the eighth day after its receipt. Now, a vacancy is created clearly when an officer resigns immediately, and that is clearly one that for judicial officers, that can be filled by the governor. But what about prospective resignations? The common law standard said that prospective resignations apply at their future date, and that was the case in Texas from 1933 to 1967. But that was changed with the adoption of the Bright Line Rule that was enacted by the legislature in 1967 that created the Vacancy Upon Acceptance Rule. That statute conflates the effects of prospective and immediate resignations. Now, the plain meaning of that statute evinces the legislative intent, as this court noted recently in Memorial Hospital, the Woodlands v. McCown. And we derive the legislature's intent to create a vacancy upon acceptance from the language of the statute. The statute is unambiguous, but nevertheless, the Code Construction Act supports, if we were to apply the canons of construction, the state's position.
Ms. Vaughn, let me ask you, you say in your brief, and I just want to confirm this, that it's how this court defines the term vacancy, decides whether Ms. Angelini can take office now or she's got to win the election in November and succeed by the election. And it depends on how this court defines vacancy as it exists in the Constitution under the governor's power to appoint, correct?
And the statute.
Well, I'm going to get to that.
Yes, sir.
Let's assume, do you agree that but for that statute, vacancy, this office would not be vacant?
I do. The common law rule would apply if only Article 5, Section 28 was there, and in that event, we would not have an election that would be triggered. If Title 12 didn't apply to judicial offices.
I'm not talking about triggering an election. I'm just saying under the vacancy, as the words used in the Constitution, if the statute did not exist, this office would not be vacant. Under any sort of definition, general definition of vacancy.
That's correct, Justice Kennedy.
So the question is, does this statute, which is by its language delimited to the title under the election code, does it somehow dictate that vacancy under the Constitution is defined differently than we'd ordinarily define it? That's really the question here.
Yes, sir. Respondent has noted, unless some law provides otherwise, then the Constitution's meaning of the word vacancy is exactly as you said. And we have some law that does provide otherwise in the election code, and it tells when a vacancy occurs. For instance, when Court of Appeals judge dies, it's occurred this year, and Justice Wood.
I think that's in your reply.
Yes, sir. Thank you. And I will reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal in this case.
Counsel, you're saying since 1967, a governor has had the authority to accept any resignation at any time after it received in the governor's office?
Yes, sir.
And that Governor Clements could have accepted Justice Esquivel's resignation immediately?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Is there any case law on that, any legal authority other than the Attorney General's 1982 opinion?
Concerning legal acceptance of prospective resignations?
Yes.
The fact is that it hasn't come up generally because...
But I mean, the short answer is no.
No, sir. But prospective resignations of this magnitude, 200 days, in advance, only the last time that occurred was in 1988, and it caused litigation that came before this court and disrupted the court then. Again, we have almost a 200-day prospective resignation, utterly out of character with typical prospective resignations. The anomaly in this case, not the governor's treatment, but the prospective resigner's use of the resigning process, is the anomaly here.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I please report, Mr. Buckwood will present argument to the respondent.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice of the Court. I would like first the court to indulge me on a personal note. For those of you who have had the opportunity to review my briefs and arguments in the past, and research in the past. I think probably you all have noted that things have improved considerably as far as our research and brief writing, and I say that because that is almost totally the responsibility of a new partner in our firm, the name of Doug Ray. He was the son of my late law partner. And he was going to make his first appearance here today and his first appearance in front of this court. Unfortunately, there's an untimely death in the family. He can't be here. But, briefs that you read are mostly prepared by him, and I'm very proud of that. On another sort of personal note, I've had difficulty in this case from the beginning trying to figure out when there was a change. That was just addressed by some of the questions before. In other words, do we have a change? We know since 1933, at least since 1933, that prospective resignations for all elected and appointed offices were recognized. That statute and the language in it indicates that that was also going on prior to 1933 because the statute attempted to validate all previous elections that had occurred before that time. So we have to assume that that practice was going on even prior to 1933. So from 1933 to sometimes later, prospective resignations were recognized, and there is not a hint, not one bit of history, not any instances, nothing on the record that would indicate that a prospective resignation would cause a immediate vacancy upon the acceptance of that resignation. So we have to look for a time. My initial response was, if there ever was a time that this could have occurred, it would have been in 1967. In 1967, there have been a number of major rewrites of the election code. One was the main one in 51. There was a significant rewrite in 67. Then we had a recodification in 85, and the things have stayed basically the same since. I had the unusual opportunity to have been a Ford fellow at that time at the legislature, and I was involved. I'm not trying to testify here, it's just by way of history, with the changes in 1967. I was also an employee because of my Ford fellowship that I, in Governor Connally's office in 1967 and through 1968, and then into President Smith's term in 1969. Then I had the opportunity to be Director of Elections starting in 1969.
Excuse me, if you don't mind, let's get off of that. Let me ask you a question.
Sir.
Under your theory, once a resignation letter is submitted, a vacancy occurs no later than 8 days after that for purposes of an election, correct?
For purposes of triggering the selection of a successor to an election, yes.
And the resignation doesn't take effect and the office is not vacated to be filled by someone else until the prospective date of resignation.
That's correct.
Let's change the facts slightly in this case and say that Justice Hardberger, who was elected to serve through the year 2000, instead of moving on to be the Chief Justice of the Fourth Court of Appeals, decided that he would go back into private practice or go fishing somewhere, and submitted the resignation letter on the date that he did to be effective February 1. 1997. That would have triggered the code, as far as you're concerned, to force an election that would have taken place as it is going to in November. Someone will be elected, and they would be ready to take office as a duly elected officer on January 1 of 1997. But because of the way you apply your theory, Justice Hardberger would still be there, and the newly elected judge would not be able to take the office because the vacancy, is, as far as holding the actual office is concerned, had not yet been triggered. So there is a conflict when it comes to applying your analysis in this case, is there not?
Well, there's a hypothetical conflict, Your Honor. This is exactly what, this anomaly that could occur. Interestingly enough, no anomaly as far as I know has ever occurred. No case in controversy has ever occurred on this issue, but you're correct. The reasoning of a respondent leads one to that position, that a person could resign very far in the future. In other words, they could make it much further than Justice Hardberger did here. It's something that was concerning now Judge Cryer in the 1989 debates over the amendments after this court's decision in the I call it the Esquivel case, the Rains case that was decided the year before. And Senator Cryer was addressing that very problem. There should be some sort of limitation. You should only be able to resign so many months in the future or whatever. Or maybe it shouldn't be, there shouldn't be any prospective resignations.
Well, then let me ask you this. If we were to decide the case the way you want us to decide it, why would we not be creating a precedent that would just lead to a conflict in the future?
Your Honor, it we have had this potential for this conflict existing for 67 years. It's never occurred. I don't think this court would be creating any conflict. I think that potential has existed there for all of these many decades.
And it's potentially an abusive potential.
I believe that if utilized in that fashion, it would be abusive, and I think
you could decide to resign the day before the end of your term, knowing that you weren't going to run again anyway, at a time that you thought would trigger an election that would be more favorable to one person or another person.
Well, of course, that cuts both ways.
Right.
No question about that. But this really truly hypothetical situation could occur, and I think that's what the legislature was talking about. In fact, it's obvious that's what Senator Cryer was talking about. She was concerned about this. Legislature has not been faced with this problem because it's never occurred. If they're faced with it, I feel certain they'll stop it.
But would that conflict, I'm sorry, just one quick question, would that conflict not exist, though, if we interpreted the statute the way that is being requested by the state?
Not saying it
would. Yes. All right. I'm sorry.
Could the legislature also could create a statute that basically would say, assuming you have an election to fill an unexpired term, the person that wins that election is entitled to take the office when that election is certified?
Certainly.
And that would solve the problem?
Certainly.
So if you've got Section 600, what is it? 601.004 of the government code that says a person that wins an unexpired term election when it's certified can take office, is entitled to take office as soon as they're certified for it, that would solve the problem.
That would be a way of solving it.
And so do you concede that, even assuming that we accept your interpretation of the statute, Judge Hardberger can only serve until his successor is duly qualified after the special election under 601.04 of the...
No, I do not see that.
So you talk about a hypothet, but in fact we do have that conflict in this case. We have a judicial officer who has given a prospective resignation. He's given a prospective resignation for the purposes of triggering an election for an unexpired term, but then sets the date of his resignation at a time into the future that would prohibit the duly elected successor from taking office.
There is no question that situation exists today and has existed, I assume, for 50 years. We've never had a case in controversy about it.
Isn't that this case right now? It's not a hypothetical situation.
Sorry, I interrupted you. No, it's not, because just as Chief Justice Phillips and I had a very detailed exchange during the Esquivel case on this very issue, to the extent that conflict exists, to the extent that it still actually exists, that case is for another day. It's not here before this court. It's a hypothetical. And what Judge, Justice Phillips was asking me and Escovel was this same question, don't we have a conflict? And I said, if the person I was representing at the time was Judge Carr, I said, if Judge Carr wants to contest Judge Escovel's continued sitting on the bench after he certified in November, then that's up to Judge Carr and Judge Escovel, and that's another case. And it is truly hypothetical, and it is hypothetical in this respect also. We, after looking at literally thousands of resignations like this issue has never surfaced, and it's not before the court at this point.
May I ask you this then? It's the respondent's position that an incumbent office holder can control the effective date of his or her resignation, even to the extent of a date in the future, here in this case, January 1, 1997. How do you square this position that you're taking, even though you say it doesn't exist in this case, with the statutory requirements of 601-004?
Well, we have two statutes. They're both statutes, and I can't.
Well, now, let me back up. You have asserted earlier in answering the questions that your position is that the, quote, vacancy exists only to trigger the election process in November.
That's
correct?
Correct.
Or would you say then that it also triggers the requirements of 601-004 for whoever gets elected in November on the opportunity to take the office?
It is the position of respondent, as it was my position in Escobar, that you can take those two statutes. One of them says it's effective upon the date of the resignation, and one of them says that if the successor gets to take office upon their certification on their election, that issue has the potential of being litigated. It has never been litigated as far as anybody, the state or anybody else. This conflict has never actually arisen. Now, it's a hypothetical conflict. I can sit here and see that, and I think I told the court that if Judge Carr wanted to try to oust Judge Escovel after he was certified, then we would we'd have another lawsuit. But it wasn't before the court at the time, and that, frankly, it would be advisory in nature to assume that something like that was going to occur. And I do think it would be a purely advisory in nature, and I believe the court, in its majority decision, noted that that would be advisory in nature in Escobar.
Well, we do have to figure out how all these statutes and the Constitution work together in some sort of coherent scheme.
Sure.
So to that extent, we'd have to look at that to see if one side's interpretation or argument would create a potential conflict versus the other. So to that extent, do you agree it wouldn't be an advisory opinion? It would be statutory interpretation.
I just don't think that it is for this court.
Let me ask you a couple of questions. Do you think the Texas Constitution prefers election over appointment, just per se? Or do you think that it provides for appointment under certain circumstances and election under other circumstances?
There is. We're talking about the Constitution now, so
yes,
go back to our framers.
Right.
In Texas, at least, we're still sticking with the intent of the framers instead of worrying about what somebody else thought at a later date. There is no question. I go back often and read Braden and just go back through the history of the Constitutional Convention and the adoption of this language, provision in Article 5 concerning vacancies and so forth, and we know that our framers preferred election over appointment. They certainly recognized that the governor had appointive authority and had to have it for an orderly transition in certain circumstances, but they favored the election. And in a case we cited, this policy has been upheld by the courts consistently. There is not a specific provision in the Constitution that says the Senate has confirmation powers over certain judicial offices. And that issue was raised not that long ago. And the courts, and that's in this case, it was the Austin Court of Appeals, which I believe this court either denied or NRE, They held that, that even though that Constitution didn't specifically provide for the confirmation of certain judges, that not only had it been being done from time immemorial, but that the policy behind the limitation on the governor's authority for appointment that is rampant through the Constitution required that these judges be confirmed by the Senate even though there wasn't specific provision.
So the answer to that question is, do you actually think that the governor's appointment of a power is just provided for as sort of a necessary evil?
I think if we had asked the framers of the Constitution in 1875, 1876, they said yes. I don't necessarily feel that way today, but I think that's exactly what they said.
One other question. Under your argument, the power of determining whether an election will be triggered more or less immediately, or the governor will be allowed to fill a vacancy by appointment, is totally within the discretion of the resigning office holder. Is that correct?
If that resigning office holder has some preferences as to what time they want to resign and when they want to make it effective, it is truly in the hands of the office holder. As I believe in reading Judge John Hill's resignation letter, Chief Justice of this court at the time, he says, please accept my resignation of Chief Justice Supreme Court effective January 1, and then he proceeds to talk about why he was going to give the court, that and then Governor Clements, that kind of notice so that there could be the kind of transition and there could be a selection process. Now, this wasn't an election year, so it wouldn't trigger an election in any case. But if John Hill had waited until 1988, and resign, he would have triggered an election process at that point.
Do you think it's good policy to have the office holder have that prerogative as opposed to the institutions?
I don't, other than outlawing prospective resignations, I don't know how else to do it.
You could take out the dichotomy. You could resign in the future, but how it triggered the election is it.
Well, there's no question that at least since 1933, they wanted these elections to occur. They did not want the governor appointing for a full term. They wanted to pick it down. There's no question about that. They wanted this to go back to the people as soon as possible. Now, my feeling about elected versus appointed judges may have changed through the year, but the fact of the matter is the law hasn't changed. The policy of the legislature hasn't changed. They want this return to the people for the selection process, if at all possible. That's the entire reason the statute was passed in 1933 and has remained there almost for all practical purposes intact ever since. There's no evidence whatsoever that any governor from John Connally in 67, 68 until the present governor wanted to say that we could not have prospective resignations and these offices would be vacated.
Is under your interpretation, is there any tension between what the legislature's written in the election code and what the Constitution provides in terms of the appointment powers of the governor?
No, I don't think so at all, Your Honor.
Could the election code be viewed under your interpretation as a restriction on the governor's constitutionally conferred powers of appointment?
No, I don't think they're a restriction at all. I think it's purely a matter of setting up a legislative scheme as a governor. Governor doesn't get an appointment, and this would be true if we didn't have the election process. This wasn't a problem with us. Let's just assume we did not elect judges. We could still have prospective resignations, and the governor would have to wait until that resignation became effective in order to make that appointment. And it wouldn't make any difference whether or not we prefer elections or we prefer appointments. The same, this case would not be any different if we did not have the election process. We do know this, the policy of the state has been not just for judges, but for all elected and appointed officials to be able to use prospective resignations and where election was appropriate that it be returned to the people at the earliest possible time.
Mr. Wood, let me ask you the question I asked Mr. Bowen earlier. At least from what I've been able to find,
at least by as late as 1943, this court has refused to entertain a Puerto Rico claim that was not first addressed in the district court. Now, neither party's addressed it, or are you particularly interested in that issue?
We did raise that issue, Your Honor, and our response, we felt that because the circumstances, that even though it wasn't specifically required, that a motion late to file would have been necessary, and we addressed the point that this court, in the only two cases that we can find, that were warrantos were brought directly in this court, in both instances the Supreme Court declined to exercise its jurisdiction, and we do mention that in our brief, and in most of these instances there's going to be disputed facts. And I would certainly agree with you that I think that this court, as it has done in the past, in these kind of situations, certainly has, the precedent would be that you return to the district court and that the Supreme Court does not entertain any jurisdiction in these cases.
Are there any disputed facts that you can conceive of in this particular case?
I don't believe now that they've been raised. I think there was initial indication in the relator's petition that there was some possibility of the intent of Justice Hardberger, where some people say I'm resigning, some people say I intend to resign, and I thought there was a fact question there, but as it's played out and as I've heard it argued in this court, I don't believe there are any disputed facts.
You do concede that the court has concurrent jurisdiction with the district court.
Yes. I think it's purely a matter, as Judge Ng has said,
discretion.
It's discretion.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Enoch, the first point I'd like to raise is your concern about the Martineau case. The legislature, post-dating the Martineau case, adopted Section 22.002A of the Government Code, which provides that the Supreme Court may issue all writs of quo warranto, agreeable principles of law regulating those writs. Therefore, the legislature has stated that as an original proceeding, this court may entertain a quo warranto proceeding. Second, the respondent raised John Hill's resignation and noted that because it was not an election year, Chief Justice Hill's resignation had no effect of triggering an election. And that points to exactly the central problem with respondent's interpretation that vacancy means only triggering an election. Therefore, Chief Justice Hill's situation, the vacancy upon acceptance rule had no effect when that resignation was accepted. Simply the common law rule applied, which meant that Chief Justice Hill's resignation became effective on the prospective date. And therefore, when Governor Clements accepted that resignation, there was no election to be triggered. However, yesterday, the respondent filed a reply to the relator's reply brief in which he stated that the election machinery of Title 12 applies to the filling of judicial vacancies. Now, Justice Forney, you raised the point that there's some tension between the Title 12 and the Constitution's judicial vacancy provision, and it's particularly focused in the date of election provision in Title 12, 201.052. And that provides that elections to fill vacancies caused by Title 12 occur on the first uniform election date, 30 days after the resignation is accepted. Well, that would mean, if that election machinery, as respondent says it does apply, that judicial vacancies are filled by special elections on uniform election dates called 30 days after acceptance. In fact, the Constitution provides how judicial vacancies are provided, are filled, and that is by appointment, and then any unexpired term is filled by election at the next succeeding general election, which is the case here.
In essence, your position is that you cannot have a prospective resignation.
I think you can have prospective resignations. What the statute does is addresses how for the officers governed by this provision, how they, those prospective resignations are treated. And in particular for say, local officers, a prospective resignation that's accepted triggers the election machinery process in .052. But
it's automatically accepted.
Because of the 1989 amendment.
So you can't in effect, resign more than 8 days after you send in the letter.
But it doesn't have any practical detriment to the appointment process in this respect, because the officer would continue as a holdover, and in fact they have as a regular matter of course until frequently to their prospective date.
And all of the cases that respondent has cited us to, the letters, the history of the appointment and resignation process, has been a matter of the governor's discretion.
That's correct. And each governor's discretion, and indeed they don't evince a pattern that's akin to precedent, because at least in the limited selection that of Governor Bush's judicial vacancies acceptance process, there have been 21 instances, and in some cases the resignations have been accepted, in other cases there's been no letter, in other cases there's just been a letter thanking the judge for informing.
What's your response to the respondent's argument that this has established a customary means of interpreting the constitutional powers of the governor to appoint, that we should defer to that customary interpretation as employed both by the resigning officer and by the governor, and be consistent with that?
Well, the prior practices of previous governors are not binding on successive practice regarding an appointment's powers, like constitutional appointments or the constitutional power of granting pardons, for example. So I think in that case you would just look at the practices of the current governor, and indeed if you look at the full spectrum of practices, there's no pattern that indicates it's akin to precedent, which is his standard for interpreting that. But more to the point, we have an unambiguous statute that directs how and when a vacancy occurs when a prospective resignation is submitted, and we have an unambiguous constitutional provision that provides the method by which those vacancies are filled.
Any other questions? Thank you, Captain. That concludes the argument in this call. The oral submission docket is concluded, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.